Welcome to the 4 o'clock session. My name is Richard Beck, and I'm going to be leading our conversation. Many of you might not know who I am. We have a few people in a big room, but I have a big microphone. I'd like to say hi to my wife. She's back in the corner over there. And so, again, my name is Richard Beck, and I'm from Abilene Christian. I'm a psychology professor there. I'm a little intimidated to talk after all of these preachers and two preachers, people who are experts in oral communication. My style is a little bit more rambling and unfocused. It's funny, the first time Jana heard me preach when we were engaged, I thought I'd impress her. And so I remember preaching, getting in the car with her, and said, "Oh, so what'd you think?" And she said, I quote, "You know, you're really smart, but when you talk, you don't sound like it." And I think that's going to be the main impression I'm going to leave with you this evening, is he's kind of smart, but when he talks, he doesn't sound like it. Anyway, but she wants me to follow up with that quote. She said she still can't believe she actually said that to me. And I figured she was the person I had to marry, right? She'd speak honestly to me through over 20 years of marriage or whatever. But she told me that she thinks I'm a better speaker now. Is that right, sweetie? Good. All right. I'm going to be talking to you in three classes about radical hospitality. And today is, this evening is just a discussion about the call to kind of a radical welcoming of other people that I see witnessed in the life of the Gospels and Jesus's life. But then we're going to kind of end today on an ambivalent note, because after I kind of paint this really big, generous vision of the love of God, it's going to get complicated, because I think we're going to kind of bring it down and we're going to kind of crash into the behavior of Christians and ask ourselves, why is it that we can't live that vision out? Why can't we do what Jesus did when he broke bread regularly with outcasts and tax collectors and prostitutes and sinners? What inhibits a church that professes to follow that one, and yet we often find ourselves struggling to be people of radical hospitality and radical? What gets in the way of that? And so the second class to this, which is tomorrow at 11, I think it's in here as well, is going to be from my angle as a psychologist about what is going on psychologically in our churches, in our hearts and our minds, that cause us to not be welcoming people. And so tomorrow at 11 will be probably one of the strangest talks you'll ever hear at this workshop. It's going to be about purity psychology and discuss psychology. It's going to be right before lunch. You're warned about coming to that talk. But tomorrow I'm going to try to do a diagnostic kind of thing about what is it about us that causes us to not welcome other people in radically hospitable ways. And then in the afternoon tomorrow, we won't be in here. I think we'll be in those other classrooms. I'll try to give you my sense about how we can overcome everything I talk about at the 11 o'clock hour. But today I want to talk about radical welcome and hospitality. And I want to start off by telling a parable. It's not my own, but it's a parable by the writer Peter Rollins. I don't know if you know who he is. He wrote a series of parables in a book called The Orthodox Heretic, kind of counterintuitive parables. And this is one of my favorite parables in his book. I'm going to tell it to you. We're going to use it, kind of guide our imaginations here this afternoon. And it was called, the name of the parable is called Hospitality for a Demon. So it goes like this. In a little hamlet, there was a priest who was well known for his Christ-likeness and his generosity and his hospitality. And late one stormy night, as the priest was shutting down his little chapel, putting out the candles, shutting the windows, getting it ready, on a stormy and thundery night, there was a loud knock at the door. Boom, boom, boom. And the priest went to the door of the chapel, and he opened up the door of the chapel, and there, hulking over the threshold of the chapel, was this monstrous demon, venom dripping from his fangs onto the threshold. And the demon looks at the priest and he says, and I'm going to do my best demon voice here. Are there children in here?
Priest, will you welcome me into your church?
And the priest says, of course, you are welcome in my church.
And the demon slouches into the church. And as the priest goes about shutting down the church for the evening, putting the song books up, getting everything organized, shutting the windows, the demon walks around and begins uttering blasphemies and profanities and tearing down the icons and profaning the sacred space.
And all this time, the priest was relaxed and calm and went about shutting things down.
And he goes to the door and he begins locking up the door. And the demon says, where are you going, priest?
So I'm going home for the evening, for my evening meal. So the priest walks through the night to the parsonage close by. The demon skulks behind him. And the priest goes in. And the demon stands at the threshold. He says,
priest, will you let me into your house?
And the priest says, you are welcome into my house. Have a seat and share my meal.
And so the priest goes about making the meal, and all the time the demon is again tearing up the icons in his own house and uttering blasphemies and profanities, disrespecting the space.
And finally the priest sets down a bowl of soup for the demon and a bowl of soup for himself, and he eats quietly as the demon continues to utter profanities at him, belittling him in his faith. And finally the meal is over and the priest does the dishes and he's getting ready for bed. And the demon says one more thing. He says,
priest, you've welcomed me into your church. You have welcomed me into your home. And I have one last request for you. Will you welcome me into your heart?
And the priest said, of course. What is mine is yours. And the demon at this point, his face falls. And he realizes he's been defeated. And he turns and he leaves and he goes off into the dark, thundering night. And the priest ascends the stairs, lies down to bed, says his prayers, and he wonders to himself, in what guise tomorrow will Christ appear to him? Now, Rollins calls that a story of impossible hospitality. To welcome a demon into your church, to welcome a demon into your house, welcoming a demon even into your heart. But I wonder if that is not exactly what Jesus does in the Gospels. And we're going to get to that in a little bit. I want to talk to you about hospitality. I want to talk to you about the long arc of hospitality from the Old Testament into the New Testament. And when most people look at the beginnings of this theme of hospitality, of radical welcome to others, they begin going back to the Old Testament in the primal text in hospitality. It's called the hospitality of Abraham, is in Genesis 18. In Genesis 18, under the oaks of Mamre, God comes to Abraham as a stranger. And the Lord appeared to Abraham near the great trees of Mamre while he was sitting at the entrance to his tent at the heat of day. And Abraham looked up and he saw three men standing nearby. And when he saw them, he hurried from the entrance of his tent to meet them. And he bowed down low to the ground and he said, if I have found any favor in your eyes, my Lord, do not pass your servant by, but let a little water be brought, and then you may all wash your feet and rest under the tree. And let me give you something to eat so that you might be refreshed, and then go on your way now that you have come to your servant. And very well, they answered, do as you say. It's this text that gets echoed in the New Testament in Hebrews. Do not forget to show hospitality because some have entertained angels unaware. These three strangers come to Abraham, collectively identified as the Lord. And that sets up this impulse all through Scripture where God comes to us as stranger. God comes to us as the stranger on the doorstep.
and failures of hospitality are considered, in the Old Testament at least, the worst sins. If you think about the two most horrific passages about sinful behavior in the Old Testament, what are they? They're Sodom and Gomorrah and Judges 19. They're parallel texts. And they're both considered to be kind of like the great low moral points in the Old Testament. And both are stories about hospitality. Or rather, radical, radical failures of hospitality. In fact, that story of Sodom and Gomorrah happens just after this text in Genesis. That there is a contrast here between the hospitality that Abraham shows and the hospitality shown to two of these visitors soon afterwards in Sodom and Gomorrah, welcoming God as the stranger. And I'd argue that carries over into the New Testament as well. Consider a couple of texts. These are well known. Where Christ identifies himself as the stranger that comes to us. Matthew 25. We won't read the whole parable. Most of you all know this already. But it's the sheep and the goats text. And the king will say to those on his right, "Come, you are blessed to my Father, and take your inheritance, the kingdom prepared for you since the creation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you invited me in. I needed clothes, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you looked after me. And when I was in prison, you came to visit me." But then the righteous will answer and says, "Lord, when did we ever see you hungry and feed you, and thirsty and give you something to drink? When did we ever see you a stranger and invite you in, or needing clothes and clothe you? When did we ever see you sick or in prison and come visit you?" And the king will reply, "I tell you the truth, whatever you did for one of the least of these, you did for me." And God comes to us over and over as a stranger. And these recognize, but the goats do not, that the homeless one, the prisoner, the sick, the stranger on the doorstep is not recognized as Christ. In Mark 9, another example of this, Mark 9, the disciples are fighting over who's the greatest, and Jesus pulls into their midst a little one. Mark 9, verse 36. Jesus took a little child and had him stand amongst them, and taking him in his arms, he said to him, "Whoever welcomes one of these little children in my name welcomes me. And whoever welcomes me does not welcome me, but the one who sent me, the Father himself." Again, Christ comes to us, God comes to us as this little one. And the one who welcomes that little one, that stranger, is welcoming Christ, God himself. Now, I think actually Americans have a lot of trouble with this text because we're a very child-centric culture. We love our kids in America. But that's not the culture Jesus is speaking to. When Jesus takes a child and puts him in the midst of these men, Jesus isn't saying, "Look how sweet kids are. Aren't we all moved by their innocence and their great faith?" When Jesus grabs a child in that culture and puts the child in the midst of them, he's actually grabbing somebody from the edges of society, right? Who's at the center of that world? Men are at the center of that world. A very patriarchal culture. Men are at the middle of that world. And then around them are women. And then around them are children. And so when these men are fighting amongst who are the greatest, who's the most powerful, Jesus goes out to the edge and grabs the least powerful person in that world, grabs that little one, and pulls that little one in here and says, "The way you treat the weakest one, the way you welcome the weakest one, is the way you welcome God.
That is how God will appear to you over and over again on your doorstep. The weakest one, the despised one, the ugly one, the God-forsaken one, the cursed one. That is how God will appear to you over and over and over. And we will say, when did we ever see you on this earth? And God will say, every day. Every day. There was somebody who was weak and small and little and powerless and ugly or in a wheelchair or mentally retarded or drooling or alone in a hospital room or alone in a cell. Every day I was there knocking at the door. When did you ever see me? You've already seen him 100 times today. The great example of this is Luke 24 on the road to Emmaus. Jesus is the stranger encountered on the road. Luke 24, verse 28. And when they approached the village to which they were going, Jesus acted as if he were going further. And they urged him strongly, "Stay with us, for it is nearly evening, and the day is almost over." And so he went to stay with them. And when he was at the table with them, he took bread and he gave thanks and he broke it. And then he began to give it to them. And it was then that their eyes were opened and they recognized him. That the crucified Lord is recognized in the act of hospitality. When the stranger on the road is welcomed in, and they break bread together, that is the moment when the crucified Lord becomes known to them by welcoming Jesus, then welcoming the stranger. Let me try to describe this in a different way. Let me describe it in a psychological way, this idea of welcoming others and seeing others. The ethicist Peter Singer talks about a thing called the moral circle. And he says, Singer's idea is that the human moral psychology is actually very simple. It's a two-step process. The first process is a simple mental judgment that marks somebody as kin, as family, as one of my own. That we live with a kind of a simple binary judgment. That there on one side there are people that are my people, my peeps. My family, my blood, my best friends, these are my people. And then there are strangers. And we automatically discriminate. Right? Think about how you greet each other here, right? Most people, as you see over there, you know, around the books, you just pass by. They're not, but if you see one of your people, then that is a great moment of reunion and recognition, right? So that's the first thing. Noticing who are my people and who are not. Then the second thing follows naturally. Once you identify your kin, you should extend kindness to them. In fact, kin and kindness are the same root. That's family affection flows naturally to people in what Singer calls those that are inside your moral circle. The people that are inside my moral circle, my kin and my family, I treat with affection and family love and kindness. And then everybody on the outside, the strangers in the world, are considered or treated in, this is technical language, what we call instrumentally. And by instrumentally, we mean like they are a tool. They are a functional thing in my world. And as a tool, they can help me get to my ends. You know, they can help me get to where I'm going in the world. Or they can get in my way. And if they get in my way, then I treat them with aggression or disdain. I mean, think about being caught in traffic, about the way you treat the person directly in front of you. You know, they're an obstacle to get out of my way, you know. So I'm honking at them. Here's the way I illustrate the difference between the moral circle, inside and outside the moral circle, with my students. Imagine you have a best friend who is waiting tables. Anybody wait tables? Ever do that job? So I did. So this is an example very dear to my heart. Waited tables through college, and your friend says, "Tonight, I've been training. Tonight is the first night I get to actually have my own section. Like, I am free. I'm not training anymore. I have my own tables. I can wait on them." And everybody and all your friends say, that's fantastic. We will come tonight and we'll ask to sit in your section. And we'll sit there and you'll wait on us and we'll have a big ball. We'll give you a big tip. It'll be a blast. We'll celebrate by coming to see you tonight at your restaurant. First night on the job. And so you go. You ask for your friend's section. You sit down and it takes them a while to get there. And when they show up at your table, they're a sweaty, stressed out mess. The night is going horribly. And there are nights like this in restaurants. Horribly. The food is coming out late. And that's not your fault. That's the perversity of it all. You are blamed for the late food. And you're not cooking it, you know. And cooks are mean. I don't know if you've ever... They're scary. And if you get on their bad side, they won't treat you nicely. It's a sad thing behind there. And so they're having a tough time. They're stressed out. Their tables are getting mad. You look at your friend... And I ask my students, what would you say to your friend in that moment? And all the time they say, we would tell our friend, do not worry about us. Take care of everybody else. When you get time, come back to us. Right? Isn't that what you do for your friends? Hopefully. Why do you do that? Because your friend is inside your moral circle. You treat those people differently than you treat everybody else in the world. And because they're inside your moral circle, it is natural and instinctive to extend kindness and grace and mercy to this friend. Don't worry about us. Get to us when you can. And then I tell my students, but imagine that you go out tonight to dinner. In fact, we're all going to go out to dinner after this. We go out to dinner. And we vaguely notice that our waitress is stressed. And maybe we don't even take the time to notice. And things aren't going well. My drinks aren't being refilled as quickly as I'd like. And the food isn't coming out as, you know, I notice that she's not functioning properly as this tool in my world. And my needs aren't being gratified. And so I start getting a little snippy with them. I stop looking them in the eye. And then eventually at the end of the night, I don't tip them. Because if I give God 10%, why should you get 18%? I know, that was a sad thing I just said. Some of you have no idea what I'm talking about, but some of you, you know, I don't tip them. Now, why do you treat this lady differently than your friend? And it's a simple difference, because she's not inside your moral circle. You treat those people very differently. You treat them as strangers. But if that person waiting your table is your son or your daughter or your mother or your best friend, they're going to get a class of behavior from you that you reserve and restrict to the very, very few. In fact, you know what? Psychologists have actually estimated the size of the moral circle. You know how big it is? Psychologists estimate it to be around 150. About 150 people in your world that you kind of treat differently. Now, if you're very extroverted, maybe 200. But if you're an introvert like me, 3, you know. About 150. That's it. Everybody else, the billions of people in the world are strangers to us. And so they're treated very differently. But here's what I tell my students. I'm saying, here's the thing. That lady that's stressed out, it's not filling your glass tonight as quickly as you would like her to. The one you're not looking in the eye at. The one that... you're going to stiff with the tip because you didn't like their service? That's somebody's daughter. That's somebody's mother. That's somebody's best friend. They're just not your daughter. They're just not your mother. They're just not your best friend or mine. So who cares? They are on the outside of my moral circle. And I think the radical call of Jesus is... the expansion of the moral circle. To live in such a way where that circle gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And that there are fewer and fewer strangers in your world. I don't know if Jesus met a stranger. My hunch is he treated everybody as if they were brother and sister or son or daughter. They treated everybody with respect. That the same class of behavior that you instinctively pour out to your brothers and sisters is poured out on even
the Walmart cashier checking you out. But you will take the time to make that interaction. And this brutal, inhuman, anonymous, capitalistic economy where we constantly interface through the markets with each other, that you will take a minute to humanize the inhuman. That you take a moment to say, you are a human being and I'm a human being and I see you and I welcome you as if you were Christ himself. The Benedictines are famous for their hospitality. They have a saying from the rule of Saint Benedict, words to live by, hospice venit, Christus venit, hospice venit, Christus venit. When a guest comes, Christ comes. There are no strangers. Everybody is inside your moral circle. When did we ever see you? When did we ever see you, Jesus, on this earth? You saw me all the time. Because I was that waitress. But it gets a little even more interesting, particularly for a conference on evangelism. Let's go to Luke 10 real quick. It's not just that we extend hospitality to other people. It's that Jesus sends us out into the world to receive the hospitality of others. Notice when Jesus sends out the 72 disciples in Luke 10. After this, the Lord appointed 72 others, and he sent them two by two ahead of them to every town and place where he was to go. And he told them, "The harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. Ask the Lord of the harvest, therefore, to send out workers into his harvest field. Go, I am sending you out like little lambs among wolves. Do not take a purse or bag or sandals, and do not greet anyone on the road." This is a great verse, right? I mean, it's an evangelism conference. But what do we do out there in the world? When you enter a house, first say peace to this house. And if a man of peace is there, your peace will rest on him. And if not, it will turn to you. And then what? Stay in that house, eating and drinking, whatever they give you. For the worker deserves his wages, and do not move around from house to house. It's not just that we offer hospitality, that we're sent out in the world with nothing but to receive the hospitality of others. And to offer a one-word sermon, peace. Now, there's a little bit more than that. You're also to heal the sick and say, the kingdom of God has come near. But the first word is peace to this house and receiving the hospitality of others. And I think that's where Jesus gets really, really radical for us. Because the kind of people he broke bread with, the kind of hospitality, the people that welcomed him into their homes were a little shady. I'm mindful here of the title of a really good book by Bob Elkbald. And Bob Elkbald's book is called Reading the Bible with the Damned. Reading the Bible with the Damned. And it's a book about his doing Bible studies with people on the margins of society, with the proverbial damned of the society. So it's Bible studies in prisons. It's Bible studies with illegal immigrants. It's Bible studies amongst the homeless. It's with the God-forsaken society. And it's about how the Bible sounds different. It's read differently on the margins of society. And it makes me think of breaking bread with the damned of society. And how things change, how we find God out there where we don't expect God. I participate, here's a story in this regard. I participate in leading a Bible study on Monday nights at a local maximum security prison. And the prisoners, asked me in the early weeks of that study, like, why do you come out here? You know, like you have a family, it's Monday night, aren't there football games on? Like, why are you out here? You know? To charity. And I said, you know why I'm out here? I'm out here because God's in this prison. I want to be clear about that with you guys. I am not bringing God into the prison. It's not like God's out there and I'm bringing God in here to you. I'm convinced that God is in here and I'm here to find God amongst you, amongst the damned. On the language of Hebrews, right? God is found where Jesus is found, which is outside the camp. Which is outside the camp. So you go to the margins, you go to where the damned are, and you find God out there. And I did. I found God out there. I'll give you one example of this. I was trying to teach the Beatitudes in a prison. That's hard to do. Blessed are the meek. And they all looked at me like, you're kidding me, right? Really, the meek in here. This is a maximum security prison. And I was talking on and they were just not buying it. And I stopped. I go, you don't believe what I'm saying, do you? And they're like, no, we appreciate what you're trying to say. But this, the Beatitudes, blessed are the peacemakers and the meek. That ethic won't work in here. You'll get killed. You'll get raped. You'll get beat up. You will not survive in here. This is a brutal world. And those words won't fit in here. And I didn't know what to say. Like, what am I going to say? Yes, they will. Yes. Yes. I know I'm leaving in an hour, but do it. You know? I mean, what am I asking them to do? It was the scariest Bible study I had ever done. Because I was terrified. I did not have the courage to tell them to obey. Because I did not stand in their shoes. I did not have the courage to say it, so I kind of backed off. I said, all right, we'll come back to this later. You know, just think about it. The whole meek thing, you know. And so then, so I let it sit. And as I remember walking out to my car, I was like, but is it any less crazy to live that out in my world? Maybe, is the world out here any less brutal? Maybe the prison that they're living in is just, it's just condensed. It's just distilled. The ethic of the world, the kind of Darwinian dog-eat-dog, it's just distilled and condensed. Because is it any really different? Is it any less crazy and death-defying to follow Jesus, to love your enemies, to turn your other cheek? You know, right? Is it any less crazy? And I realized, I don't think I'm all that meek. I mean, why am I preaching meekness to them? I'm not that meek. You know? If you attack me, I'm probably going to get mad and attack you right back. I mean, I'm not particularly loving. Particularly if you're not outside of my moral circle. So we came back to this when we were working through the Gospels. We got to back to Jesus washing feet. Jesus takes off the towel, night who's betrayed, washes their feet, says, if I am the Lord of all, do this for you, you do this for each other. So we're back on this servant-heartedness, and I'm looking at them, and they're still disbelieving, looking at me. And I didn't run away from it this time. I settled on it. I said, can you do this? Can you serve? Can you wash feet in here? Just stony silence. But I waited. And finally, on the front row, Mr. Noriega. I call him Mr. Noriega because he's a very large man and he scares me. And everybody respects him. He's a big guy. He raises his hand. He goes, I'm not sure what you mean, but I help my cellie. I help my cellie, my cellmate. I go, great. How do you help your cellie? Because my cellie's not too smart. He's not right in the head. And everybody jumps in. They agree. He's not right in the head. He's apparently he's borderline mentally retarded is what the situation is. And he's so mentally incapacitated that he really needs somebody to kind of take him by the hand and guide him through prison life. And so he's just not that sharp in the head. And so then he said, well, when I first got my cellie, he would never take his shoes off. And I was kidding. Why don't you take your shoes off? Why don't you ever take your shoes off? He would never take his shoes off. Never tell me. And finally, after some weeks, why don't you ever take your shoes off? Why do you not take your shoes off? And his cellie said to me, he confessed to him. He said, I don't know how to take care of my feet. his feet had gotten so overgrown and nasty and fungus laden that it was out of control. He just did not know how to take care of them, and so he just would not show his feet. So he just left the shoes on all the time, which made it worse, obviously. And so Mr. Nuorgi said, so I had my cellie sit down, and I took off his shoes, and his feet were a mess. And I had him put his feet in water and soaked him. And then I put him in my lap. And he says, and I have no idea if anybody had walked by our cell at this moment what they would have thought. But me taking his foot in his lap of his mentally retarded cellmate, and I began to trim his nails for him. And then he looked at me and he said, is that an example of what you're talking about? And I said, yes, that is an example of what I'm talking about. And so that's why you go to where the damned are, because God is out there doing things, working amongst people. That's why you visit prisoners. It's not because you're an agent of light. It's because God is out there, outside the camp. That's why you visit the dying and the sick. That's why you visit the mentally retarded. That's why you wash and nurse people that can't wash and nurse themselves. That's why you go. Because that's where God will find you. And so that's what Jesus does. He goes amongst people where religious people have abandoned them. So let's bring this to an end in Matthew 9. And this will set up our conversation for tomorrow at 11. In Matthew 9, Jesus has accepted the hospitality of a tax collector, Matthew. You know, I don't even think we get this, you know. I don't even think we get the tax collector thing, you know. Like how they were perceived as betrayer, you know, as traitors to their nation, you know. I mean, maybe we need to come up with some other metaphor here. Like Matthew fought with the Taliban in Afghanistan. Does that cut a little bit? Somebody who turned his back on his country, and Jesus hanging out with this person. You know, what do we think tax collectors were? They're not accountants. They're strong-arming their fellow countrymen for the Romans. How would that feel if somebody did that to Americans? And that's the kind of trash Jesus is hanging out with. And so Jesus went from there, and he saw a man named Matthew sitting at the tax collector's booth. Follow me, he said. And he told him, and Matthew got up and followed him. And when Jesus was having dinner at Matthew's house, many tax collectors and other sinners came and ate with them and his disciples. And when the Pharisees saw this, they asked his disciples, why does our teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners? Why does he do that? Our teacher. And on hearing this, Jesus says, it is not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. And go and learn what this means, that I desire mercy and not sacrifice. I desire mercy. I desire mercy and not sacrifice. And I ask, have we learned that lesson from this teacher? What's going on in this story? Why are there a group of religious people standing on the outside across some sort of moral quarantine saying, what is he doing over there with those people? He's on the wrong side of those railroad tracks. And he quotes Hosea 6:6, I desire mercy and not sacrifice. Go and learn what that means. Radical hospitality. Radical welcome. And what we have to ask is, why can't we learn this lesson? Why do we struggle so with it? Why do we get to the threshold and say, you know what? Does he really mean for us to hang out with those people? Does he really want to send me there? What will happen to this community if we start embracing those kinds of people? if we start welcoming those people into our churches, into our homes, and yes, even our hearts, what will happen? And so we rather erect this quarantine. And so Walter Brueggemann says this about this text. He says, in the life of Israel, there were these two competing impulses. There was the Levitical impulse towards purity. That's the sacrificial aspect. Moral purity, moral quarantine, inside and outside. That was the ethic guiding the life of the Pharisees. That was the judgment that was guiding their logic. That's why they were saying we should be on this side and not that side. That purity impulse sets up a kind of social expulsion. And then against that Levitical strain is the prophetic strain. Care for the foreigner and the orphan and the widow and the outsider. The fasting that God really wants is justice and mercy. And so Hosea echoes down and Jesus quotes the prophets. And so Israel had in front of it two paths. The path of purity, the path of mercy. And Jesus votes for mercy. And he quotes the prophets. And when I see pictures like, when I see stories of like this of Jesus, my heart breaks. I love it. I'm like, I want to be like that. I want churches to be like that. I want us to go out and give hospitality. I want us to go like Luke 10 and be sent into the world and receive the hospitality of the world. And you know what? Whatever they put in front of you, you eat it or you drink it. Like, what is this? I don't know. But eat whatever they put in front of you. You know? Just take their hospitality. I'd like to be like that. And yet we can't, and we struggle with it time and time again. And I think it goes back to this purity impulse. And what I want to do tomorrow at 11, same spot, is talk from a psychological perspective about what it is going on in our hearts and minds that causes us to not be people of radical welcome. Jesus, when did we ever see you? You got to see him, and already have. Be people welcome and grace. Go with God. Have a great dinner. See you back tonight.